This morning, I spent a few minutes talking about the importance of the choice of believing and how each of us are on a journey. And sometimes that journey has a lot of chapters and twists and turns to it, to how we come to the place to believe who Jesus is and to live that out in a world that can be very confusing, can be very oppressive to faith, but how to know beyond a shadow of a doubt in our hearts who Jesus is. And I want to talk about the guards tonight and the Roman soldiers that are part of the story that comes to us in the crucifixion and the resurrection. It's really tied a little bit to the same topic as this morning and how important in the early church the witness of the resurrection was. And that was became a spiritual warfare, wrestling between good and evil, between truth and a lie. And we see a little bit of it right at the end of the story in the book of Matthew. But as we kind of look at it a little bit more, we can see that as truth is proclaimed, also Satan is trying to distort the truth. He always does for everything, for moral questions about right and wrong, about relationships and what God wants for us, about everything in life. Satan wants to take what is good and destroy it. For example, Satan wants to destroy the life of a little baby, an unborn baby. Why? Because he wants to kill and steal and destroy. And so many people who are Christians stand for life and for helping, trying to help men and women in this area of their life. That's just one little example, but we see the struggle, the spiritual warfare that goes on about moral issues, about sex within marriage, about immorality on our TVs and phones and magazines and music and all that stuff that God wants good to be done. Satan wants to bring evil out of it and pain out of it. And it's true of everything in life, that everything that God created for good, Satan wants to take and make into a lie and destroy. And the same is true about the truth of Jesus and things that Jesus did and said and are a part of the story of God. Satan wants to take and distort it and make it look different than what it is and for people not to know the truth. Well, tonight I want to talk about the guards, the soldiers at the resurrection, especially. The book of Matthew and the book of Mark kind of are the two that give us the most about the soldiers. Matthew especially. And tonight I want to sing. I don't want to sing. No, I'm not going to sing. But I'm going to read from chapter 27 and 28. So if you have your Bible, this would be a good time to follow along, I think. I want to talk about four pictures, four clips of what we see of the guards and the soldiers and their interaction with the story, and then come to the place tonight as we look at the great lie, it's called by some. But start in chapter 27, verse 54, and the first clip there, 54, it says, "When the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, 'Surely, he was the Son of God.'" So there's clip number one, the recognition of the centurion that Jesus was the Son of God. Now later in the chapter in verse 62, it says, "The next day, the one after the preparation day, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. 'Sir,' they said, 'we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, after 3 days I will rise again. So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come and steal the body and tell the people that he has been raised from the dead. This last deception will be worse than the first.' 'Take a guard,' Pilate answered. 'Go and make the tomb as secure as you know how.' So they went and made the tomb secure by putting a seal on the stone and posting the guard." Okay, number three, verse 2 of chapter 28. "There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and, going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning and his clothes were white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men. And then number four about the guards, verse 11. While the women were on their way, some of the guards went into the city and reported to the chief priest everything that had happened. When the chief priest had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, "You are to say that his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. If this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble." So the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed. And this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. See if I can get this going. Okay, we're making progress already. Jerusalem and all of Palestine, during the time of Jesus, really, from his birth and his childhood and growing into a young man and then his entering into public ministry and his years of ministry, Palestine was a land that was in constant turmoil. There was problems between the Jews and the Romans. You probably know that the Romans occupied Palestine with their army during the times of Jesus. And so there was constantly this political and military presence of the Romans, and they were not liked by the Jews, and some Jews hated them. And there was tensions that took place between the Romans and their laws and their system of government that they forced on the Jewish people. They allowed the Jews to have a certain amount of autonomy, but in some areas they took away that freedom, and they insisted that the Jews would do exactly what they told them to do. Most of the time, what they told the Jews to do, probably not totally unreasonable. Rome and the Roman army did believe, and they said, and it was stated that they would rule by Roman law. And if you followed the law, then you were okay, and if you didn't, you were in trouble. And so there were times in Palestine where, even though the Romans were hated, at least they provided this system of living and government by which they forced upon the Jews. So they were the occupiers. On the other hand, you had the Jewish people with this great history and story of how God had given them the promised land. It was to be a blessed land, and they were to serve and honor God and follow the law. And at one point, that even God would be the leader, the direct leader of the people, but they had rejected that long ago when they wanted a king. And so they had the kings, the period of the kings, and that worked for a while, but it still wasn't very good. But by the time you get the story of Jesus, you have this mixture of two things going on, the Romans and the soldiers. I mean, the army occupied Palestine and Caesarea, which is that beautiful port city right on the Mediterranean Sea, about halfway up the coast of Palestine. You had Pilate live there, and the Roman army was garrisoned there for Palestine, and they would go from there to Jerusalem or to other areas, to Galilee, wherever they were needed to force the people to do what they told them to do. So you had Pilate, the governor. He lived most of the time in Caesarea, but he came to Jerusalem because Jerusalem was a capital, and he would come there and he would try cases, and he would make decisions, and he would give direction to the soldiers and to everybody else in Jerusalem, including Herod and the high priest and the Pharisees. And so Rome was in charge. Pilate was in charge, and he enforced the collection of taxes, and that wasn't very pleasant for the Jews. And then you had these Jews who sometimes got along with the Romans and kind of coexisted with them, but you still had this undercurrent of tension. The Romans could be very brutal sometimes, and the Jews could be very uncooperative sometimes. And so you had this conflict that took place constantly. Part of the conflict was with the religious system, and you had the Pharisees, and they were arguing with the Sadducees, and the high priest was supposed to be in charge, and at times in their history, the high priest was not very moral, and so you had a lot of forces and dynamics going on the high priest was very political, and that created moral issues and problems. You had Jews who resisted even their own religious leaders at times, and they resisted the Roman army. So you had this constant cauldron of turmoil that took place. At times you had the Romans who punished the Jews and did cruel things to them. The Romans pretty much let the Jews worship their God. See, one of the main differences between the Roman Empire and Palestine is that Jews worship one God, monotheistic, and that was so important to them. That's a part of their identity, one God. Whereas the Romans had all their gods, as the Greeks did. They had a pantheon of gods, and the Jews were different. They believed that if you worship more than one God, and it came back to Moses and the Ten Commandments and one God, and anyone that worshiped more than one God was not connected to the God of Israel. And the Romans usually let them do that, but there were times when probably corrupt and evil and cruel, more cruel Roman people would try to make the Jews worship other gods, and that happened at times. But so you had that tension there. So you had the Pharisees and the elders and the high priest. Then you had Herod to deal with when you're thinking about this cauldron. The king of the Jews, the evil, the Herod the Great, who was so evil, and he had so much anger. And he was brutal, and he would put down uprisings. And if he was not successful, then the Roman soldiers would have to come in and have that done. And so there are a lot of feelings about Herod as well. So now we move to the soldiers part of it. And couldn't have been easy at times to be a Roman soldier. I don't know how it compares to Egypt or other provinces of the Roman Empire. I'm sure there was violence and problems, but Palestine was not an easy place to serve as a Roman soldier. I get that impression anyway. Well, the Roman soldiers were a part of everyday life. They were free to do basically under Roman law whatever they wanted to, and Jews had to put up with that. And they certainly were tools and instruments of the Roman brutality that took place. They certainly were in Jerusalem and directly involved in the story of the crucifixion and the resurrection. They were large characters in the story. You think of Pilate and how first the high priest wanted to have Jesus killed, and then he went into trial to Pilate, and Pilate then ordered that they would be whipped, and they were beaten by the temple guards, and then they were beaten by the Roman guard. Jesus was, beaten really twice by the temple and abused by the temple guards. And then so you have the temple guards, which follow the direction of the high priest, but they're still under the law of the Romans, and they could only do what the Romans allowed them to do, but they were brutal in themselves. They're the ones that arrested Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. It was the temple guards that got them there. But when they took them down to Jerusalem, down into the city, then they were under the care of the Roman soldiers. And so the Roman soldiers were there, whipping Jesus, taunting him, making a crown of thorns, torturing Jesus, these Roman soldiers were. So when we think about the Roman soldiers and their part too, they also played a heavy role in the crucifixion and what happened. They divided his clothes by lot, if you remember that story. They were there as Jesus hung in the darkness on the cross. They were there watching, forcing him to make the journey, Via Dolorosa, from the place of the Praetorium eventually to the cross. The soldiers there in their brutality. Why don't you think just for a minute tonight about those soldiers that were at the cross? For those hours, probably about 6 hours at the cross, roughly, something like that. Darkness from the 6th to the 9th hour, from noon to 3 o'clock, and at 3 o'clock when Jesus likely, according to the story, it seems like they breathed their last. Imagine who those soldiers were and what they thought. They crucified people all the time. Many records of crucifixions, not only in Israel, but all over the Roman Empire. That was, at the time, I guess, their preferred mode of putting to death people. And They were used to the suffering. They were used to the brutality. Usually it was for criminals, probably, who deserved it, if you can use that term. I mean, they at least were criminals, but this one was different. This one was a man that did not deserve it. And Matthew records a special, a picture and a story at the cross that, you know, I read over this a lot, but today or tonight I just kind of wanted to focus a little bit more on that. Matthew records the reaction of one of the soldiers. He's called a centurion. And Matthew records when the centurion, who stood in front of Jesus, heard his cry and saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." So you have the proclamation of a Roman soldier, a centurion at that, who's watching Jesus. He heard his cry. I don't know which cry, the words of Jesus when he cried out in pain, the words of Jesus when he said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." I don't know which words of Jesus it was that he heard and the cry that he heard of Jesus, but there that centurion was at the cross watching and listening. And through that awful day, this centurion comes to the place to say, "Surely this man was the Son of God." In part, it says, he saw how he died. I think of all the things that Jesus did on the cross, recorded on the cross, and the uniqueness of it. I'm sure others who were crucified had their story too, but the uniqueness of Jesus' death on the cross, his compassion. Can you imagine if the soldier was there and the other two criminals are crucified, and over the course of those early hours, the one is cursing God, and just looking over at Jesus, and he'd probably heard people call him, maybe he read the sign above the cross, who Jesus was, the King of the Jews, and he's cursing God. And then the other thief calls out to Jesus and pretty much acknowledges that I deserve to die. But he puts his faith in Jesus somehow. He knows enough to put his faith in Jesus. Jesus says, "Today you will be with me in paradise." You imagine the soldier, the centurion, hearing that conversation. What? What's this man talking about? "Today you'll be with me in paradise. Who do you think you are? What do you think you are?" He's wrestling with, who is this man on the cross? So he's listening. He hears his words about his mother, about his thirst. He hears the words, "It is finished." What's finished? You're dead. You're dying. That's what's finished. Or did he mean something else? But whenever he took his last breath, this is what the centurion said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." What a powerful thing for a Roman soldier to say. In the Protestant church, we do not keep the records and cherish the stories of the individuals like the centurion because we hold more to exactly what's in the scripture we regard as authoritative and informative, and that's what we read and focus on. But there's a large part of the Christian church that cherishes more stories like this in some ways. And the Catholic Church, for example, the Eastern Orthodox Church, and almost all of the Christian church except the Protestant church, half the church or so, cherishes the story of the centurion. And church history, according to them, knows who this person is. His name was Longinus. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing it right. I've heard his name a long time ago. In fact, when Paul Pitts was here, any of you here, you remember when Paul Pitts came and he dressed up as a scribe, as a soldier, and told his story? And he said, "My name is Longinus." And I thought, well, that's a nice name. I wonder where he got that. I just thought he pulled it out of, you know, a Roman name. I didn't know until I was studying the story of the centurion fairly recently that Longinus was the name of the centurion. And according to the Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox and those churches that record more events about people, and some of them I think they make up, I don't know, some of them might be true. I mean, if I told you everything about Longinus, you'd probably, like me, go, "Wow, I don't know about that." But His name was Longinus, according to church history. And according to church history, soon after the events of Jesus' resurrection, Longinus quit the Roman army, according to church history, because he became such a passionate preacher for the gospel, according to church history. He actually is sainted by these churches, which means they went through a process of deciding if the story was true and whatever they thought. But Longinus, according to church history, soon after the resurrection, he was so moved by, according to church history, the identity of Jesus and believing it that he wanted to tell people. And so Longinus quit the Roman army and he became an evangelist. He became a very effective evangelist, and he actually ended up settling in Cappadocia, which is an area of Asia Minor, kind of on the northern part of Turkey. Today it's above Syria, where Syria is today. It's in the area of Mount Ararat. If you kind of look at a map, the area of Cappadocia. And according to church history, he became a passionate evangelist and preacher of the gospel. But he didn't last very long because he was martyred fairly early on, because of his faith and his preaching. And his martyrdom was brought about, supposedly, by the Jews in Jerusalem who had sent messages to Cappadocia because his preaching had been so effective that so many people were come believer in Jesus that they wanted to silence him, and he was actually beheaded. He was an early martyr of the church. This man who stood at the base of the cross and said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." He knew who he was. Whether or not or where he was at on the resurrection morning, he may well have been one of the soldiers that were at the cross. It's very possible that the same group that crucified Jesus then was assigned to the tomb. That's possible. And according to church history, that was the case. And he was the only soldier that wouldn't go along with a lie that we're going to read about in a couple of minutes. And that's part of the tension that he had. And he ended up leaving the Roman Empire. Well, that's the first story. And then there's three more stories, short clips about the guards at the tomb. First one's about the soldier at the cross, and the next three are about the soldiers that we find at the tomb. And beginning here in verse 62, we read where the chief priests and the Pharisees go to Pilate. Now, what's happening here is the chief priest and the elders and the Sadducees and the Pharisees are all very, very nervous about what's going to happen. They have seen to putting Jesus to death. They didn't physically do it. The Roman soldiers did, but they called for it. They begged for it. They got the crowd. They basically harassed Pilate and basically made Pilate feel like if he didn't, then they were going to say that he was actually not loyal to the Romans. And they were full of such hatred for Jesus. And the chief priests had said earlier that why would not one man die instead of the whole nation? He's talking about the conflict with the Romans. Put Jesus to death and we won't have these problems. And they didn't know what was going to happen. They surely knew the power of Jesus. I mean, they saw it. I mean, they saw this man that had been healed and had for 40 years been sick, and Jesus healed him, and then they tried to silence him. And they knew that Jesus was a miracle worker. And they knew about Lazarus. I mean, earlier in the week, they said, or it's recorded in the text that we read last Sunday morning, that because of the testimony of Lazarus, they were trying to find him and put him to death too. People were believing because of Lazarus. The Pharisees, the chief priests, knew that Jesus was absolutely incredible. They probably also knew that he was the Messiah. I don't know for sure. They had to have known the scriptures and known how Jesus fit all that. Yet in their heart was such rebellion against God that they would not accept the authority of God. You can know who Jesus is but not accept him. The demons knew who Jesus was. You remember that? But they didn't. They weren't changed by that. Even the demons believe, Jesus said at one point. So you have these leaders who know about the story of Lazarus. And so they go to Pilate and say, "Pilate, resurrection thing's, got us nervous. And you know what he said back there? He said after 3 days he's coming back. We don't believe that. No. We don't believe that. But we got to somehow make this tomb as secure as possible so that... wrong button. There we go. Doesn't matter. Okay. So they go and they try to convince Pilate. "Sir," they said, "we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days I will rise again.' Then later on, 'This last deception will be worse than the first.'" Here are these religious leaders, deceivers. They're calling Jesus the deceiver. They're trying to paint this story to Pilate. This man has been deceiving the people. And then look at the deception that comes. And so Pilate, I think Pilate was probably disgusted with him. You know, he says, "All right, do what you have to. Go make the tomb, it says, as secure as you know how." Okay. You don't believe this guy is going to resurrect. You don't believe it. So go ahead, make it as secure as you know how. I wonder what Pilate thought. You know he didn't want to crucify Jesus. That was obvious from before. What did Pilate think at this point? I wonder about that. Make this tomb as secure as you know how. And so they do. They seal the tomb, which meant somehow, I don't know how, this picture kind of portrays it as some kind of wax or something that goes over the stone and against the entrance. So that it's, if the wax is broken, then they know that somebody broke into the tomb. Something like that. And soldiers. How many soldiers? There are different people... have said different amounts, 4 soldiers or 16 probably. I won't get into that, but you have put the soldiers in. Roman soldiers were pretty tough. They were the best. I mean, I think you would say, whether it's 4 or 16, that tomb was probably pretty secure by man standards. It would take some real planning probably to get into that tomb, according to the high priest and Pilate. As you know, the soldier's job, if they don't do it and they complete it, especially if they would fall asleep at the task, you imagine what trouble they'd be in. Of course, we know what trouble. They'd be put to death. And another story talks about them being put to death. So the soldiers are there. The tomb is sealed. Make the tomb as secure as possible. And then fast forward with me to the next story, to chapter 28 and the I call it resurrection moment, the resurrection second. When our speaker was here a few Sunday nights ago about the Shroud of Turin, what did he call it? The resurrection nanosecond or something? Whatever it was, millisecond or whatever. He said, suddenly, some power came into that tomb and burned this imprint on the cloth that he believed is the burial cloth of Jesus, the light, the power, whatever it was. What we do read about it is there was, number one, a violent earthquake. Can you imagine what those soldiers were thinking then? I mean, they'd probably been there. I don't know if they were there continuously or they had shift work like others. I don't know about that. But the guy's there in the morning anyway. You know, maybe they'd been there all night. My guess is they were careful about going to sleep, but, you know, they knew the consequences of that. But they're there all night. Things are absolutely dead. I mean dead. Dead and quiet. Nothing's going to happen, you know. But then the angel of the Lord comes. You imagine the soldiers then. Their appearance was like lightning, the scripture says. They're white as snow, their dress, whatever this angel of the Lord looked like. And the angel rolled the stone away. So, I mean, here, this stone supposedly, at least in the pictures we see portrayed, it weighs 3,000 pounds, you know, or it's round and it rolled downhill into the spot anyway. I'm not sure, but it's pretty heavy. And not just one person's going to move that stone. No. And they watch as that angel comes down, the earthquake and the and the lightning, and he rolls the stone away. Just imagine that as the guards watch that, rolling that stone away. And how do these soldiers react? Well, they're absolutely afraid, of course. Who wouldn't be? Would you expect them not to be? Would you not be, you know? Think of all that's happened in Jerusalem and the crucifixions and the anger and the hostility about from everybody. I mean, they're afraid of Pilate. They're afraid of the chief priest. They're probably looking over their shoulder constantly to make sure, you know, that they're not going to be attacked by some mob, some Jewish mob, which they had to deal with before. But I tell you what, this was a different kind of fear. I mean, they thought Pilate was bad. Imagine this. The guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became as dead men. Wow. They shook. Have you ever shaken because you were so afraid? Anybody ever been at that place that you were shaking because you were afraid? When I was a kid, I was afraid to go in the basement by myself for a while. And afraid, so afraid that they shook and became as dead men. Afraid of Pilate, probably. Afraid that their centurion's going to find out that they messed up, probably. Maybe the centurion was with them. But boy, compared to the angel, those other guys weren't very scary at all. But when they saw the angel, they shook and became like dead men. And so what do? Maybe they go to the least scary of all of them. They go to the chief priest. Why'd they go to the chief priest? They were probably afraid of Pilate, for sure. They knew if word got back to the governor that they failed and they failed their job, that they would be held accountable for it. They very likely would have been put to death. Maybe, too, they didn't know what to think. What is this? We saw him die, and the centurion, you know what he said about him. And these soldiers are now, they encounter the power of the resurrection, and maybe they don't know. They want to go and ask religious leaders, what is this? Who is this? Why did you want him put to death? Is this angel going to come and get us? I don't know what all they thought and think, but they didn't know what to think. So what do? They go and they speak to the chief priest and our last part of the story here. When the chief priest had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, "You are to say his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep." So they go to the religious leaders and they have a little conference. And what do? Well, they come up with a bribe and they come up with a lie. A bribe and a lie. And so they tell the soldiers, "This is what we want you to do. First, we're going to pay you real good." See, that kind of buys you to stick to the story. Actually, three things he promised them. You got to stick to the story. No wavering from this story. This is what you tell people. And they give them a lot of money. And he also says, "We'll protect you," because everybody knows, as I said before, that if Pilate finds out about this, man, we'll protect you. If this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble. And so this lie is hatched. Again, the deception. Who did they say the deceiver was? It was Jesus, they told Pilate. Who's the deceiver? The deceiver is the one who is prompting them to construct this lie, to tell this story. A large sum of money. "We will protect you. Tell them that the disciples came and stole the body." Well, how are we going to tell them that 16 soldiers couldn't beat off a couple disciples of Jesus? That makes sense? Hey, don't worry about it. If the story gets back to the governor, we'll cover you. And they probably had some plan to hatch it, probably, we know. Again, according to church history, Longinus is the one that wouldn't go along with it, and that's why he left Jerusalem and left Judea, according to church history. But the deceptive machine was on, and it was a deception machine. This is what Matthew writes, and this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. Of course, Matthew's gospel was written probably 30 to 40 years after this, probably, not sure of the date. But when Matthew put together his account, the deception was going strong, and it would go strong. In fact, this would be one of the primary false reports that the early church dealt with constantly, is the story, the lie. It wasn't just one lie that was sent out, but it was a lie that was circulated and circulated and circulated, so much so that in the early church fathers wrote about this lie and talked about how it was sent out from the Jews, not only in this generation, but the next generation, to fight this growing belief and people who accept it and believe that Jesus rose from the dead. You realize the truth that Jesus rose from the dead was the central story for the gospel to go out. He rose from the dead. Also, he died on the cross, and that's a part of it, but you see throughout the book of Acts, especially over and over again, the focus is on the rising of the dead and the story that's being told, the resurrection. This story was widely circulated because the truth was also being widely circulated. Think about Peter on the day of Pentecost, and he tells the story. He almost starts the story when he preaches to the people in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost. He starts the story just about it with God rose him from the dead. And then he tells them who he is. The rising of the dead was the main tenet, a main tenet of the early church and the belief and what happened there. And then if you think about the Apostle Paul, we've been reading and studying about Paul on Wednesday nights the last few months and on and off with that. But you know how many times we've read a story about Paul, and in that story he includes the words about the power of the resurrection. Everywhere he goes, Paul is proclaiming the resurrection. Every audience he goes to, especially to the Jews, he tells them that Jesus raised from the dead. And then in 1 Corinthians and many other places, but one place, I just pulled one of them out, if Christ be not raised, we are dead in our sins. Paul said that. The resurrection was the key story. It was a powerful story in the early church. And as truth is powerful, so is the lie. And so they continue to circulate the story that it wasn't true. The disciples had come and taken the body. That was the big lie in the early church. And the resurrection is a big truth. That's why... And also in Corinthians is recorded the words about how Jesus appeared to the women and two men on the road and to the apostles and then to 500 others. And we have the telling that there were a lot of people who had seen the resurrection of Jesus. And then throughout, especially Paul's writings, over and over again as he preaches the gospel to the Jews and the Gentiles, over and over again he says, Jesus rose from the dead. Jesus rose from the dead. The power of the resurrection. All the apostles were willing to die proclaiming that. You know, people have said, you know, why would those 11 men that are left be willing? They had to really believe that and know it. You know what I mean? I mean, it's one thing to tell a lie. It's something else to say, I'll die for that lie. And boy, did they. According to church history, all we know is James was beheaded, but, you know, the others from church history. But the way some of them died, and it wasn't just the 11 of the 12 apostles. It was like this man, if this story is true about the centurion, and so many others in that first century, in the second century, later in church history. Then we go to today and the people that are dying for their faith. Because they believe so deeply in the truth of the resurrection that they're willing to stand up. They're willing to die because of that truth and that faith. And so this story to me and these soldiers just remind me of the power and the importance of the story of the resurrection. It's a precious story. Any thoughts or comments that you have about resurrection or